This is a poem about Merlin, who gets a lot of, I think, very romantic kind of play in the Camelot legend as it's presented. But the Merlin legend is something else altogether. It's got to do with old Celtic tales of men of the woods who probably were tribesmen who chickened out in battle situations and went into the woods, and then they couldn't come back because it would mean disgrace and death. And legends grew up about them. Yeah, these guys knew more about nature because they're out in the woods, and their bodies are covered with feathers or leaves. And you can see on certain British cathedrals, even, you know, well, certainly you can now because they still are, but you can see what they call the green man, a kind of a face peering out of the leaves, along with the saints and Jesus and Mary and so on. You can see this kind of mad face, you know, kind of peering out of the foliage. So this poem actually started out as an elegy for a student of mine who came and who was interested in what I would call the Camelot version of the Arthurian tales, and who, because she was in Wales and got interested in the, I don't know the way you can call it, the historic, but the other, you know, the deeper kind of interpretation of these tales, got interested in that, and she went off to Scotland. This particular student went off to Scotland against all her advice by herself, backpacking, and fell off a cliff and drowned. Well, I started this out as an elegy for her, but it's something entirely different. It's got nothing to do with, you know, what I think about actually happened to her, but I got to thinking about the quest for the unknowable ultimate in nature, that kind of thing. It's Moby Dick writ small, you know. Somebody, and somehow it seems to me, and I don't want to go into that, and that it's important that this is a young female rather intelligence. It seems the poem's only possible in that context, but that doesn't. But that's because I think the, you know, there's a greater intuitiveness there at that time in life. But it's called Running Clean, which running clean means, you know, I think, you know, the desire to have final knowledge of something. And this person comes to Wales looking for Merlin, doesn't find the Merlin that she was looking for, but something that's very compelling, and goes up to the Highlands, the old Brythonic Highlands, and, well, I allude that she goes off a cliff. It's called Running Clean. Something cold and running clean was in her that first day. She was keen. Her dossier said she came first in everything. The movement of her mind, the winter weeks, I knew it, bore it out. Cold was in her, wanting clean. She was green. She came to Wales intent on legend. Merlin caught her up. She ran with the romancers for the month or so she had to, then stood still and let them clear. She turned her mind, went back after what it was the name of Merlin had to fail, something dark and prior in the high green wood, a thing too old to story, uneasy in the leaves, the restless shifting of the lambent light. A presence as of shadow, edging, strange, there with rock and water, colder than she thought, moving always, close to clean. Water raged at rock below. It was an old place, high. It was where she came to go. Green to the edge. It was spring and cold. She was not wise to go alone. She was keen. It was strange and high. The place hung clear. beyond the wood. The green at edge grew thick. It tangled into air. Water raged. It raged at rock. It ran cold and then clean. I'd like to read a poem that the Post-Dispatch, I think, said that, you know, I'm a local prize-winning poet or something like that. I don't want to make a liar out of them, but I thought I'd read a poem that won a second prize. And Vince Lombardi said, you know, second place is hinky-dink. And this is a poem about sports. In 1978, Dylan Thomas died in New York in 1973, and so the National Newspaper of Wales had this contest in 1978 for a 25th anniversary of the poet's death prize. I agree with Robert Frost, really, that, you know, you should always enter every contest you can, because poets get so little, you know, recognition anywhere else, that you should get all the honor you can to enter contests and so forth. And it's like the Illinois lottery or something, because really it depends on who's the judge. And it doesn't matter, you know, you're different judges have different tastes. I hope to demonstrate, you know, here, but as the judges of this contest were a male poet who I know, and a female poet I know, both of who are very well-known Welsh poets, and the third judge was Ranwy Thomas, who was Dylan's daughter. So there were about 900 entries, and the procedure was that the male and female judges, both of whom were recognized poets in Wales, would draw up their short list of eight poems. Well, there was no duplication. The man had eight, and the woman had eight, and there was absolutely no duplication. And I was number one on the one list, and number zilch on the woman's list. So Ranwy Thomas, who, after her father had died, had published this collection of verse in the 60s, and then had wisely, I thought, you know, decided not to write any more poetry, but who had devoted herself to doing performances of her father's poetry with her husband, and is quite a lovely young woman. And I found all this out later, but this all happened, and that everything was all balled up, and Ranwy Thomas came, and so they had to adopt kind of an AP football poll kind of procedure to decide who wins, you know. Assign point values, and that's what happened. But this hinky-dink poem, you know, wound up second by 0.5 point anyway. It's called The Rugby Men. And the idea of it is that what do you do with a nation that has no political recognition? Suppose that the U.S. had been, suppose that Canada had 20 times the population of the U.S., and we had been incorporated into Canada, and there was a Canadian language as well as an American language, and that somehow that the Canadian language had kind of pushed our language out to the point where only 20% of the people spoke the American language. We might resort to baseball, you know, to preserve some sense of national identity, and that's the idea. The idea that it's a pretty poor substitute, but that somehow you might, you know, in a really critical cultural situation, have to say, well, maybe that's the only thing that is the only vehicle that can carry the national identity. And that's, and in 1978 in Wales, I thought that was quite a possibility and still think so. Rugby's the national sport of Wales. Some people call it the religion. Some of you probably play rugby. It's amateur sport in the way that tennis used to be in America. You know, if you're good at it, why, you're set for life. You know, you get jobs with breweries and PR man for the rugby ball company and so forth. And the Schweppes company sponsors the Welsh Cup, which is the equivalent of the Super Bowl. Glyndŵr is the last of the great Welsh heroes who led this uprising in the early 1400s. And that's the reference there. Wales is, of course, a peninsula, but the guy speaking purports to speak. It's like saying, I am the National Football League man, is kind of what this guy's saying. He's saying, I am the rugby man. I am the rugby man. What I do is as significant as running a business, standing for office, laboring, loving, writing a poem. You must not doubt it. For all the chic assertion, it is only a game. True, my palm is crossed. The Schweppes is in my cup. I take convenient jobs. A specter slicks my book. These are my prerogatives. It is I who both keep the doubtful manhood of this moldering nation comatose and stoke its faint dream vision that it might prevail. It is I who both nurture and subvert the ardor of the boys, which but for me might dissipate in sport less like small war. As the cerddi, those are Welsh language poems, as the cerddi flicker and go out in the west, I pack a hard green residue within my chalked rectangle. I render sometimes, discipline come clean. It is not for me or you to say, but if one day this wretched peninsula regains by half the dignity that foundered with Glyndŵr, it may be I who have allowed it, in my ignorant, fierce, and singular pursuit of a dumb-stitched thing, a tribe's dark pride, the last that, one long time, we had. Well, I'd like to read you a couple of poems from the Bible. William Faulkner said, in regard to his novels, and certainly put it into practice, that you change the point of view in any given story and you've got a different story. And he also said that the Christian mythology, which is what he called it, was something that the Western world had fallen in love with and, you know, had never been able to fall out of love with because it seems to be so metaphorically fundamental in terms of the way we perceive our experience. So years ago, I had grown up in Granite City, Illinois as a member of the Presbyterian Church and had felt that this had somehow given me a kind of a sense of order in the universe, in the way that Albert Camus said of his experience in playing soccer in Algeria. And I played so much soccer in Algeria that I had this feeling there were rules and borders, and no matter where my mind took me later in terms of existential, you know, speculation, I always had this sense of security. And I felt that about the Presbyterian theology. And so I took my kids back to the Second Presbyterian Church at Taylor in Westminster in St. Louis and taught some Sunday school. And I found that the kids really loved the story of David and Goliath, except that for the wrong reasons, I thought. I thought, you know, Goliath is a poor kid who's been victimized, and these kids think he's the symbol of ultimate evil and that David is all good and so on. Whereas David, to get his first wife, actually went out and slew 100 Philistines and brought back their foreskins to Saul. And to get his second wife, he instructed his captains to leave poor old Uriah out there in the vanguard and let the Philistines kill him. So he wasn't really a very moral character. And the whole Goliath seemed to me to be kind of a victimized character. So the idea of this poem is that some MC is on the stage and he's saying, we're going to bring on Goliath, let's hear it for him, we're going to tell you about him. And it's called Let's Hear It for Goliath. Let's hear it for Goliath, who never asked to be born either, let alone grow 9 feet tall and wind up a metaphor. Fat chance he had of avoiding a shove from behind. His old man no doubt gave him a sword to teethe on, and a scout for the Philistine host probably had him under contract by the end of junior high. It was a fix, and who wouldn't have cursed at the sight of that arrogant runt with the sling, who, for all his psalms, would later buy one wife with 100 bloody pecker skins and another with a king's X on Uriah. Bah! Let's hear it for Goliath, a big boy who got bad press but who did his job, absorbed a fluky shot, and died with a thud. This is about the prodigal son. It's told by a kind of a New York Jewish actor who had auditioned for a role in this little parable, which is all you could get in those days because it was a day of, you know, the kind of the New Testament, and there weren't any big plays going on the way they used to be in the old days, and so you had to play your part in this, and he didn't like it because he didn't think it was dramatically extensive or fulfilling enough, you know. But he took the part of the brother who stays home and who has to listen to the father say, well, you know, the other son is home now. And though he died, though we thought he died, he lives and so forth. But he's pointing out that it'd be a much better play if they continued it. It's called A Real Trooper because the speaker is this actor. He says, of course I never would have signed on for a parable if anything full scale had been up for casting, but in those days, brother, there was only one show going, and you did your bit part in it or they booked you into the Apocrypha. The director is Jesus, of course. He never gave us half a chance. I mean, he rang down the curtain on a rising action. Every bumpkin on the farmstead getting high as fire on Sinai. The old man anointing my head with platitudes, the calf assassinated, and all for the guest of honor from Gomorrah, lassitude come home, in the corner in my good robe, ogling milkmaids, boobs, and acres. He wouldn't have lasted a week as a field hand for all his humble matzo. But you can bet your last cold kosher veal chop the old man would have kept him on for ego fodder, which was what the commotion was all about anyway. And you know who'd have had to ante half the silo. Ha! Huh. Now that would have been a part to carve beef for, worth a grown man's talent, to the curtain, like Orestes, Hamlet, Judas, Cain. This is a poem about Lot's wife, who I always thought that she got a raw deal. It's a very macho kind of a story, you know, that all of this stuff is going on in Sodom and Gomorrah, and the angels of the Lord are going to come and rain down the fire and destruction, but Lot was, you know, should have been as curious as his wife, but only the wife looks back, and she gets turned into a pillar of salt. Of course, Lot goes on to the cave with his daughters, and they get him drunk with all the wine, and they sleep together, and he, you know, the result of this is that they father the tribes of Israel. But I always wondered, what did they do with the wife? You know? She was turned into this pillar of salt down there on the plain. So what happened to her? So this is called Lot, some speculations. I mean, what did he do? One minute there she was, flesh of his flesh, hustling along beside him, anxious as ice cubes to get away from all that fire and justice on the plain. And the next she's a pillar of wrath, solid salt. It was a hell of a price, even if her curiosity was morbid. What did he do? You could make a case for not even breaking stride. But after all, it was his wife. He may have carved a quick R.I.P., not looking back, before goose pimpling on, or something more sobering, like beware. She may have become a kind of sodium chloride Ozymandias. More likely, she wound up and ground up in some market or licked to a nub by beast tongues. Yet there's a chance just a chance. She may... The three of them may have carted her along, clear to the cave, where in her corner, cool as the moon, she whitened all that wine and incest, all that girled conniving for the seed, the sons, the tribes. There's a story in Wales about this Welsh prince who discovered America, you know. Of course, the Norse have got these stories and all. The Welsh have got this story about this prince who in the 1100s had this quarrel with his father, and he left with 20, 25, you know, Welsh warriors, and they came here, and I don't know how they did it, but they supposedly landed in Mobile, Alabama, and there's a monument down there. There's a monument in Mobile, Alabama, put up by the Daughters of the American Revolution that says that in the year, you know, 1182, that Prince Madoc landed here. Columbus and everybody else ran into the Bahamas, you know. How these Welshmen got around Florida and up there, I don't know. But that's the story. And the story is that they intermarried with Indians and that they went up into the Dakotas. And there are indeed, you know, there were some French explorers who went up to the Dakotas and lived with the Mandan Indians who actually wrote down phonetically the words of this Indian, the language of this Indian tribe in French phonetics, and it's so close to Welsh, about 40 or 50 of those words, that it's really spooky. So this story is, you know, kind of lived on, even though everybody, really you think it's impossible, how could it be? But still, how could those Indians in the Dakotas have the same word for daybreak that the 11th century Welsh did? Anyway, this is about Prince Madoc. The idea is that he did indeed come over and he did this thing and integrated with the Indians. Then he had to go back to Wales. The legend says he did go back to Wales, and of course he saw the awful stuff that was going on there. The English were wiping out the Welsh and the Tudors were coming in, and who were supposedly Welsh but quickly became Anglicized, and that it was kind of the end, and they came back for the second time in 1492, and they all just kind of went up to the Arctic Circle and smoked a peace pipe and laid down and let the wolves and whatever eat them up, you know, and that's kind of a version of this legend. I call it a bedtime story because at the end they do kind of lie down, but it's about that Welsh legend of the Welsh discovery of America. Said, what finally happened was this. He came back to Wales with a handful of his own and a passel of Indians. Of course, a few less of braves and a sprinkling of papoose. I always thought the plural of papoose should be papoose. They beached their boats and made their way into the hills of Gwynedd, traveling by night and holing up by day. They endured for three centuries Indian lore, etc., eating roots and berries, hunting a little, and murmuring to Manitou. Vague rumors spread of a tribe of Indian Welshmen with dark skin, straight black hair, and words like ugh and how in their vocabulary. They had the Indian eyesight, and from their hills they saw it all, the burning of Deganwy, the business at Kilmary, Glyndŵr at Corwin, Harlech and the last. They watched the Tudor procession to Bosworth and knew it was time. They built it huge, a cross between a canoe and a coracle, put it in the Mauthach as the tide turned one full moon, and paddled it back to Alabama. For 7 years they trekked due north, reaching the Arctic Circle in the month they called Hudra, which is October 1492. On the 11th night they reveled, and on the 12th, after an Italian and a scurvy gang of Spaniards had planted a flag on a sunny beach far southwards, they doused their fires, smoked a final pipeful, and lay down glad to meet their fates, which came in dreams like ice and wolves. Thank you very much.